This is Keywords and I'm Zoe Cummins. This week, I'm going to step into the shoes of others and travel with writers through their short, self-recorded pieces, all prompted by journeys. You'll hear the work of Jim Power, Paula McGrath, Kerry Ní Gocaitigh, and Mairead Kiernan. In our first piece, Jim Power is forced to take alternate transport, and as he rides the bus every day, he starts to notice the people around him and consider their lives.
I don't consider myself a bus person. Not that I have a problem with the bus. I remember clambering on the 13A with my mam as a young lad, helping her to drag shopping bags on board, always making for the top deck. The view out the upstairs window gave a completely different take on the route to my estate, allowing me to peer over walls and hedges that would be otherwise off limits to a smallish 10-year-old. Or in later years, taking long bus rides between cities in Australia. There was something pleasing in occasionally waking on a long bus ride, the window framing a snapshot of a town or city that was completely different to the previous stop, or to back home for that matter. Drifting back to sleep, wondering about the lives of the people glimpsed outside. No, the bus was good to me over the years, but in recent years, I was definitely a car person. A slight indent in my seat where my backside settled. My radio stations pre-programmed. You get used to having control over your transport. So it was out of necessity that I went back to the bus. At first they said the car part would take 2 days to arrive. Then 5. Then 10. It was due to supply chain issues, they said. The war in Ukraine, they said. So I looked up the timetable and found that, to my surprise, there was a bus that left not far from my house and that stopped not far from my office. The first day, I only brought coins. The bus driver said in future that I needed a green card from the shop. So I got that. The first few days were strange. I felt like a royal that had lost his crown. Gulliver and Lilliput. I was putting my foot down on an imaginary accelerator, frustrated by the lack of progress, looking at my iWatch. But by day 4, I settled a bit, not as bothered by the fluid arrival and departure times. I sat beside Trevor, a third-year university student. We talked about his digital and new media course. I chatted to the bus driver, Paddy from Clare, who was previously driving trucks, but was happy with his hours now. As my stop was the last in the route, I started to note some of the regulars. I asked Paddy about a wild-haired, middle-aged man. He wore a high-vis vest over his jacket and regularly left his seat to talk to the driver. "That's Seamus," Paddy said wearily. "He likes to give me directions." "And where does he go?" I asked, noting that we were the last stop. "Nowhere," Paddy said, shaking his head. "He stays on the bus for the day. But some days he shakes things up and takes the 42C. There was another person that didn't seem to get off the bus, an older lady. I didn't want to ask Paddy about her, in case he thought I was stalking her for her pension. On day 8, she sat down beside me, near my last stop. "I'll rest my bones here for a minute, love," she said, not noticing that I knew she wasn't going near the exit, but looking for some company. She said her name was Maura, and that she was 79 years young, and laughed when she said it. Her husband was dead 5 years this September, God be good to him. She sat down beside me again on day 10, and this time admitted that she hadn't anywhere particular to go, but it made financial sense to be on the bus for a lot of the day. With the increase in the heating and the ESB, "I can turn it off during the day and be warm and cosy on the bus," she said, tapping her head to show she had it all worked out. "And sure, I go to bed when it gets dark, so I don't have much need for lights then." I moved back to the solitary world of the car not long after that, and I can't say I missed the bus too much, but I do think of Maura each time I leave a bus pull out, and the parallel world she belongs to.
When you travel, you learn about others through observing them or retracing historical routes. And if, like writer Paula McGrath, you go on literary journeys, you discover cities in a new way simply by retracing the places those writers have been. But sometimes you set out and an unexpected event can make all your intentions fall away. In this next piece, we travel to Paris and back home again, where Paula McGrath witnesses a short encounter she can't forget.
I'm in Paris. I'm walking from my hotel in the Latin Quarter to Rue Guénégaud, where Beckett's first published work, a poem called Horoscope, was prominently displayed in the window of its publisher in 1930. It's early evening in November. The light is fading. Children are coming out of school, walking or cycling or scooting home with their parents, some stopping for crepes and hot chocolate on the way. I think I'd like to have been a Parisian child. A flock of birds whooshes through the tunnel of the street at speed. I wonder where they're going. I'm passing galleries, a vibes and vibration shop, cafes, bookshops, bars. The gallery Surrealist is nearby, and now I'm turning into Rue Guénégaud. And here it is, number 15. I'm standing where Samuel Beckett might have stood before he put his poem through the letterbox a minute before midnight, the deadline for the competition run by the Hours Press. On the way back, I take a detour to Shakespeare and Company, site of my first literary pilgrimage. I was 18. I hoped Mr. Joyce would rub off on me. I imagined becoming one of the legendary tumbleweeds, helping in the bookshop by day in exchange for a bed in the small apartment above it. Some years ago, teenaged me was beyond gratified to find my own first novel on those famous shelves. There's a queue, always a delight outside a bookshop, but it's aperitif time. I'm not here for Joyce or Beckett. I'm here for Nancy Cunard, who set up the Hours Press and ran the competition and awarded top prize to Samuel Beckett. Nancy Cunard, who, despite being one of the major figures of the 20th century, known for her work as an editor, writer, publisher and activist, as well as a muse and socialite, is known today to just a handful of mostly academics. Reading and writing about her life was my pandemic project, and I wanted to walk where Nancy had walked. My literary pilgrimages began with Joyce. Keats came next. Equally young and pale, I shed a tear by the bed where he died, in a house near the Spanish Steps. That was the direction this essay would take. Literary journeys would segue into other Paris trips, each superimposed on the one before. I'd describe rows with my Francophile boyfriend on that first trip, a visit to my sister many years later with my four-month-old strapped to my chest. The swirl of bookshops and interviews when my novels were published in French. A family trip, enjoying my boy's first impressions. And the conference I've travelled to this weekend, where I will give a paper on a panel aptly entitled Tales, Tracks and Traces. I would retrace old selves through old journeys, perhaps illuminating something, who I was and who I have become, sort of thing. Tidy. The return journey was not entirely smooth. An early morning walk to Gare de Luxembourg, where I would catch the train to Charles de Gaulle, felt unsafe. It was dark and no one was around. At last, I reached the station. The next train was due in 7 minutes. I had plenty of time. But when I stabbed the screen of the ticket machine, nothing. It was out of order. There was no ticket office, no one to help. XXX, the ticket barrier said, do not pass. In desperation, I contemplated shimmying underneath, but even in an empty train station, it was an indignity too far. I ascended the escalator to the still deserted street. I spotted lights, a man and woman outside a hotel smoking. They worked there, they spoke English, they were sympathetic. She offered me a coffee, he phoned a taxi, and I was soon on my way. I could still make my flight. At the airport, I joined the omnipresent queues to check a bag, to reach the correct gate for EU passport holders, to passport controls, to security. And then a scuffle behind me, one of the stanchions crashing to the floor. Alarm spreads through the queue. Instinctively, we close the gaps between our bodies, between us and them. Two security guards wrestle with a black boy of maybe 17. He's tall and gangly, wearing a faded t-shirt and jeans, carrying nothing. His left arm locked behind him by a security guard, his other struggling to stay free. It looks staged. No one's heart really in it. Where was he going? Where did he come from? My journey fell away. All my journeys, with their minor inconveniences and epiphanies. I shuffled forward, we all did, careful to avoid each other's eyes, not wanting to witness there the mirror of our own shame. I could not get him out of my mind as I moved towards security, estimated waiting time 5 minutes. As I filled red plastic trays, one for my coat, one for laptop, phone, Kindle, my Sorbonne Nouvelle tote, all my things, they go through their machine, I go through mine, and we're through to the other side to Chanel and Gucci, lattes and croissants, we who traverse borders with ease. I could not get him out of my mind, his face made beautiful by confusion and anger and pain.
From Paris through the airport, and now back to the streets of Dublin with an early morning drive. Some journeys are memorable for the fun, the sights or sounds, often the company. But when accompanied by trauma, they are unforgettable. Writer Mairead Kiernan travels home with her boyfriend from hospital.
Say something, I tell myself. Say something that will matter, something that will help. But nothing comes. Liam and I are driving across Dublin. It's 5 a.m. on the 11th of February, 2021. Liam's mother, Cait, is dying in Beaumont. She won't make it. They've told us this, and even if the doctors hadn't said it directly, you know it's bad when they tell you to come to the hospital during lockdown. You know it's the end. Dublin is deserted. And I mean deserted. Totally dead. We drive from Bayside, Liam's sister's house, to Park 8 Street where we live. We don't pass another soul on the roads. There's no one driving down the coast road, no one walking their dog. It's just us. It feels like we're the last ones on earth. I still can't think of anything to say, so I put on the radio. It's all bad news on the airwaves. I glance at Liam staring out the window in the passenger seat. He won't want to hear about COVID and war. Then again, does he want happy? Does he want distraction? How do you serve someone in this position? All I want is to take his pain away. We find a song on one of the stations. It's Rocky Took a Lover by BellX1. I haven't heard it in years. It's a song about love, a song about being in the gutter, a song about existing for your loved one. It moves me and tears spring to my eyes, but I wipe them away on my sleeve. I shouldn't cry right now. It's not the role I'm supposed to play. But the song feels like it was sent to us as a gift from Cait to tell Liam the things that I can't. How does it go? I'll shine for you. Oh, no. Get the idea. We park and sit for a minute. Home sweet home. We let the noisy engine cool down. We're back. But it doesn't feel like we're home. It feels like we're somewhere new entirely. Come on, I say. Time for sleep. We get into bed. Liam's on his phone for way too long, scrolling, staying up, stalling. I wait beside him to hold him for a brief moment, but even holding each other feels too much. We turn off the lights and turn away from each other. The room is heavy and silent, neither of us sleeping. There's a ringing in my ears that I try to muffle by thinking about nonsense. I want the whitest of noise to drown it all out. I force myself to remember the day as it was, before we got the call that changed everything. I think about the episode of Drag Race we watched and who got eliminated. I remember that I never replied to that work email. I actually get quite caught up in these frivolities and the ringing goes away. Liam's breathing deepens and that puts me at ease. I can relax now. The days that follow are hard. The standard serving of grief mixed with the absolute strangeness of a funeral in COVID times. Liam's family rally together and do Cait proud. The whole community does. People are really kind. I find myself thinking back to the song that took us home. I want to tell Liam that I felt his mother's presence that night, but I'm afraid of sounding mawkish or worse, intrusive. Cut wasn't my mother and this isn't my grief. I'm the girlfriend. I'm still an outsider in the family, relatively speaking. But I never keep thoughts to myself for long. Bit of a blab, truth be told. So when Liam is less raw, I remind him of the song that played. I wonder if it felt significant to him, like it did to me. Liam doesn't remember the song. He barely remembers the journey. But he says something interesting. "Mam always loved that song," Liam says. "Really?" I say. My heart leaps. Liam thinks about it. Actually, I'm not sure about that. She also may have never heard it. I laugh. So does Liam. It tickles us that the song may have held great significance, or none at all. It's one or the other, and we'll never know. Obviously, I choose the former. I choose to believe that she took Liam home under her wing one final time.
Thanks to Mairead Kiernan. In many of tonight's pieces, our writers have journeyed in the company of music or the words of other writers. The poem Snow by Louis MacNeice features in our next piece. The poem On the Surface is about the speaker looking out the window onto a snowy landscape and the beauty of that scene. But as it says in the poem, the world is suddener than we fancy it. It reveals the complexity of all our lives. There's the contrast between the beauty and danger of the world. The snow and pink roses of the opening lines of the poem make a lifelong impression on the woman in Kerry McGuckerthig's story. As she recalls them, they prompt painful memories of loss.
On the tongue, on the eyes, on the ears, in the palms of one's hands, there is more than glass between the snow and the huge roses. From Snow by Louis MacNeice. They are pink, the roses. I am almost certain of it. Although perhaps I have decided that we detail all for my own self. No matter, of course. They are pink and they were picked just that morning. The garden's last and astonishingly beautiful song. And the snow was almost certainly not forecast. That snow would fall silently, dutifully, folklorically on the huge pink roses. Even though it is the time for tangerines and therefore stars and twinkling lights and silver coins made of chocolate, seems preposterous and all at once like the only thing that could even possibly happen, you understand. I have read this poem this year more times than I can even try to count. I have long been drawn to it, moth to flame, so to speak, but this year, this winter, I have begun, it appears, to crave it. It has moved my desire for this poem from the casual, the ordinary, the banal, into a somewhat grey area. As grey as slush, you understand. I do not think it would be correct to say it is mere desire any longer, this thing I feel. The word I am looking for here is need. Pure and simple. I waken in the early hours before time can remember its own name, and I am hungry for the poem's imagery, its rhythm, its terrifyingly sharp insight into what it means to be alive. Hungry like the wolf, you understand. I have read it in dozens of different places. On the loo, in the glass house, at the foot of the herb garden, as I try to tame the unruly yellow brick road fennel. I have read it in bed over and over again. I have cried at the sheer chaos of it, the way its reality trips over its own self, how the kaleidoscope twists and turns out of control and in again, out and in, out and in. I have read it as Jerry knocked and knocked on the half door with the post, you see. Softly at first, then a little louder and more forceful, knowing full well I was home. Of course I was at home. I've been nowhere but here since all that stuff began. You understand? But knowing too, I imagine, that I just no longer had it in me that day to even pretend that things were okay. Poor Jerry, and his shaky hands, his greying, thinning hair. I have read it moments before the phone rang, with news I'd been expecting for over a decade, but that caught me off guard, unlike anything else before it. News that left me winded, like the day I fell off Nessa's day-old red pushbike. Embarrassed too. So very, very full of shame. That same shame every single one of us women on this island carry in beneath our oxters. That shame is a darker shade of pink altogether than those roses in that crazy plural world. A darker shade by far and much less tender. Just this morning, as the cat played with the head of a grey mouse, like a child would a colourful ball, I found myself thinking back on the very first time I heard it. There had, of course, been other snow writing before this poem. Sure, look it, we don't need to go down that road again. Well, we know about snow being general all over Ireland, falling on bogs and waves and churchyards. But the truth is, my obsession with this poem doesn't really have much to do with the snow. Yes, the snow is part of it. I'll give it that. But for me, the truth is that never before had a piece of writing so fully resonated with my own insides. Right down deep, in beside my bones. That poem found me the day I lost the most precious thing in my life. I say thing when really I mean things, for there were two of them somehow. They hadn't known before they came that there would be two, or if they had, they hadn't told me. And I say lost when really I mean gave away. Through into the lion's den of a world they'd only just been hauled into. I kept them safe for three whole seasons, despite it all, despite every last bit of it, and there I was, casually dropping them into some other bird's nest, like the callous cuckoos we used to wait for, year in, year out, to tell us when the winter was really done. Believe me, I'm not looking for your pity here. I'm long done playing the victim. This is just to say that the poem came like a bolt from the blue, that heart-scalding day. I don't even remember the cutty's name, who gave me the book she was reading on the dart, when I tried, but failed, to answer if I was okay. And I have no recollection as to the ins and the outs of that whole time, except to say that when I cried, it felt like they weren't even my tears anymore, like I'd gone underwater and held my breath too long and nothing was the way it was supposed to be. But that poem was just as strange, just as sad, just as startling as my insides felt back then, and I felt like I wasn't alone anymore, like I was just a small part of the oddness and the wildness of a curious, unknowable world. They aren't far off 40 now, the pair of them. And sometimes when I'm on that part of the line, I wonder if they might be on the same train. In the same carriage, even. I wonder if they ever think of me like I think of them. I wonder if they hate me as much as I once hated me, or if they have found a way to understand. I wonder if they have their own children, if either of them ended up having twins. I wonder if they made snow angels the years when it came. If when they did, they went to bed and dreamed of lands far away, of Christmas and of dancing lights. I wonder if they ever dreamed of me.
That's all for Keywords this week. Tune in next week for stories and recordings, all prompted by the keyword surface tension. Thanks to the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland Sound and Vision Scheme for supporting this series.